This is Lawrence Spivak inviting you to meet the press with the governor of California.
Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, and the world's oldest network television program, is a public affairs presentation of NBC News.
Meet the Press is brought to you by Exxon. Exxon has shown you this map before so you could see where the world's oil is located. Most of it is here in the Middle East. But now we'd like to change the picture to show you what the world would look like if the size of each country were in proportion to the coal reserves under its land. The United States would become this big because our country has almost one-third of the world's coal reserves. Europe and the Middle East are small by comparison. And if you look closer, you'll also see that much of this coal is in the West, where states like Montana, Wyoming, and New Mexico account for about 40% of America's coal reserves. If you add these deposits to the coal in the rest of the U.S., America comes out with total coal reserves equal in energy to twice the Mideast oil reserves. And this is why Exxon is hard at work to find better ways to mine coal, cleaner ways to burn it, and new ways to put it to work.
Our guest today on Meet the Press is the governor of California, Edmund G. Brown, Jr. Governor Brown was elected in 1974 after serving as California's Secretary of State for 4 years. He was graduated from the University of California and received a law degree from Yale. Before that, he studied 4 years for the priesthood. His father, Edmund G. Brown, Sr., also served as governor of California from 1959 to 66. We'll have the first questions now from Bill Monroe of NBC News.
Governor Brown, you have been compared with Ronald Reagan and George Wallace because you and they criticize bureaucracy, big government, big spending. How valid is that comparison?
Well, it's as valid as any other journalistic metaphor. It attempts to put things together that may not fit together. Certainly, I see the limits of government, especially big government, the failure of many programs that were touted to solve intractable problems that just haven't performed. But as a matter of fact, my fundamental commitment is to full employment, to equality, and to the kinds of things that those two individuals, at least in their past record, have been very far from.
The AFL-CIO was meeting in your state in the last few days, and they were talking about less work for more pay, about a 35-hour week, double time for overtime. Isn't that exactly the opposite of what you have been calling for, namely, get less but work more?
Well, it's true in part that we have to redistribute the work so that everyone in this country has an opportunity to work, and that means that many will have to work less so that we can all work more. Whether that's going to mean we all get more money, I doubt that. I think we are going to take less. But those at the bottom who are even below the minimum wage, certainly you can't ask them to take less. I always like to say that those with the biggest belts ought to make the biggest sacrifice and tighten them up the most.
Isn't your approach as to what is going to happen in this country remarkably pessimistic for a political leader when you say we're going to have to work more and get less, when you say that the American standard of living is not going to keep increasing as it has in the past, and that the government can't help people very much?
Well, I don't know whether you want to call it pessimistic or optimistic. I consider it to be accurate. And the first requisite of politics, as of many things in our life today, is clarity. And the clear perception that I have is that we're reaching the outer limits of our economic potential, and we're going to have to work harder to expand them any further. Those at the lower levels and the middle levels, we're going to have to be particularly sensitive to. And those at the higher reaches who are enjoying the corporate and special privileges, we're going to have to examine very carefully their privileged positions and cut them back a bit so that as all of us are asked to sacrifice, we can all sacrifice equally. People are ready to make a sacrifice for the betterment of this country, but only on a basis that we all bear up the burdens and bear under them on an equal basis, and that's not happening today.
You've just met Bill Monroe of NBC News. The other questioners on our panel today are David S. Broder of The Washington Post, Richard Bergholz of The Los Angeles Times, and George F. Will of the National Review. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Broder.
Governor, you told Mr. Monroe that your fundamental commitment is to full employment. Many of the other Democrats who are considered potential presidential candidates have endorsed the Humphrey-Hawkins bill, which would have the federal government guarantee jobs as the employer of last resort. Is that an approach which you would take?
Well, not being a candidate, I haven't read that bill and wouldn't want to comment on it. But I will say this, that if we adopt as a principle the concept of full employment that we supposedly adopted back in 1946 with the Full Employment Act, I think we'll make a major step forward. How we attain it, that's another question. I think it involves loosening up the money supply. It involves continuing the tax cuts. It's going to involve some major investments in the future, whether it be in transportation or energy or rebuilding the cities. How we go about doing that, I frankly can't tell you today, and I haven't found one person in this country who can do so. But it's going to involve a major commitment by the national government with respect to the corporate union power of this country. And I think we are all going to have to focus on it and very soon come up with some concrete steps.
When you spoke about redistributing the work, what did you mean?
I was responding to the question of lowering the work week and indicating that it isn't fair that some have more opportunities to work while we leave idle so many others. And when we face the prospect of unemployment insurance being paid out for 2 years, people in their middle stages of their life being set adrift in our uncertain economy, that's unconscionable. It will destabilize our system and ultimately will be very destructive. So as a people, we have to make up our mind once and for all that work and doing the business of this country is a prime requisite, more important than efficiency, more important than continued growth, and one way or the other, we're going to have to arrive at it.
Well, you posture yourself as a critic of big government, but if I understand you, you have said that in principle you don't object to the government guaranteeing a job to everyone in this country, and you don't object to the government moving in now to reduce through legislation the work week. Is there a contradiction there?
No, I don't think there's a contradiction in everything. There are elements that have to be meshed together. What I'm concerned about is the proliferation of government programs under the guise of doing something that they don't do. We have manpower training programs that were supposed to put people to work. All they did was put manpower trainers to work, not manpower trainees. We have a law enforcement administration that has spent billions supposedly reducing crime. It hasn't done that at all. We have an economic development administration in the Commerce Department that supposedly develops the country economically. It's done nothing of the kind. So there's a bankruptcy of many of these social programs that have been part of the Great Society, been part of the whole New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society tradition. We have to re-examine them, see them for what they are when they don't work, and find ways in which the federal government, through setting a national direction that the multinational corporations, that the unions, that all of us are going to have to get behind. It's more of a direction than the idea that the government will find a home for each person in the country. I don't want to see the federal government be the employer of last resort in the sense that everyone who can't get a job somewhere finds a nest in the federal bureaucracy. The federal government has to set the tone and the direction and has to adjust our tax policies, our tariff policies, the flow of currency in and out of the country in such a way that the principle of full employment maintains the dominant position in all our thinking.
Mr. Burkholz.
Governor, you've been kind of busy with state business, but following up some of the things that Dave and Bill have mentioned, could we get into some specifics on the national level?
You always do like to get into
specifics. Yes, if I could, please. Specifically, the Congress now has before it the President's veto of the federal hot school lunch program. Could you tell me, sir, what your view is on this? Should the veto be sustained?
Well, again, this is a bill I have not read, but in the legislature in California, I signed a bill 3 days ago guaranteeing to every poor child in this state at least one hot meal a day. That was the largest money bill that I signed. I feel very strongly about it, but That bill was something I worked on, and I know that it applied to those most in need. The president said that this would expand it beyond those in need. But as a general principle, this is a very excellent way of providing the income supplement to those most in need.
You, if you were a member of Congress, would you vote to sustain or?
I haven't read the bill, and since I'm neither a member of Congress nor a candidate for national office, I've devoted myself to what is here in California. But the hot lunch program, although it's something that I can raise question about, because I'd rather see money flow directly to people and let them make their own choices, among all the social programs, it's one of the better ones, because it's something concrete, it's something valuable, and it goes into people's stomachs, which I prefer to the bureaucratic paperwork, which often characterizes most of the other social programs.
Congress also is going to have to vote on the Sinai Agreement. Could you tell me, sir, what your view is on that?
The Sinai Agreement? Well, I don't know that I know all of it. I read that there may be other codicils that haven't quite surfaced. But if we're talking about our commitment to Israel, I think we have a very strong moral commitment to Israel that we have to maintain. I think it has political implications because it is a democracy, because it's a buffer in that area, and we have to maintain it. At the same time, it's going to become increasingly difficult in view of the Arab pressure on the European countries.
It includes, obviously, the use of Americans as technicians and observers. Would you support this principle?
I support, in general, since I can't give you a complete rundown on what it involves, but I'll say this as a matter of principle, that this country has a world role to play, that we cannot retreat from that responsibility, and that involves the Near East. It involves a strong economic and military presence, and that's something that I think a lot of people, especially at the liberal side of the spectrum, are not willing to face up to.
Mr. Will.
Governor Brown, it has been written of you that some of your political heroes are Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong and Gandhi, not for their ideology, but for their asceticism and their approach to public life.
And I also find William Buckley certainly an interesting person in the political domain, as well as Mr. Burke and a few others.
He'd be glad to be included in that.
Well, as a fourth ascetic, yes. And
don't find him too ascetical, but I find his thinking...
Well, Chris. It has been said of you that these people are attractive to you because you're interested in some fundamental change in American values. Do you believe that American values, in some sense, need reformed?
I think American values need reassertion in terms of their fundamental roots. I think there's been an overemphasis on the ability of material comfort, on the ability of our economic machinery to provide human happiness. The growthmanship of the 60s that equated the growth in the GNP with human happiness, I think that's far from the founding fathers. I think the notion that human nature changes is a complete absurdity, refuted by every chapter of history that I've ever read. And to that extent, I wouldn't call it a reform in the sense it's something new, but it's a returning to a traditional view of human nature that looks to fundamental principles, to right and wrong, to ethics, to morality, to a sense that human nature is constant, it is weak, it needs a type of government that recognizes that mankind is really brought down by its own instincts, and we ought to recognize that. We're not going to create a new man or a new person in this country. So to that extent, I think our values are a bit out of kilter. If we think that just producing 2 and 3 cars apiece and an economy of obsolescence and increasing mobility and material accumulation is the good life, I don't believe that. And I don't believe any society has ever survived on that basis. And every civilization that has gone to a sensate, sensual culture has fallen. And I think that's a real possibility. And to that extent, I'd like to see an austere, leaner commitment on the part of the people of this country. Yes.
Governor, the median family income in the United States today is $13,000, which is a lot less than the governor of California makes. In what sense is a family living on $13,000 given over to too much materialism and sensual life?
They're up against it. But there are a lot of others who are living the good life on tax shelters, loopholes, expense accounts, and the conventioneering that they indulge themselves in. And I don't think that we're ever going to raise in a tremendous way the average income. But I do think that the excesses of those on the top ought to be limited, so at least we have a greater sense of equality. But more than that, as a point of national purpose, I think we do need a greater discipline, a greater sense of restraint, you know, whether that be in the army or in the civilian sector. It takes sacrifice. It takes struggle. And when we face off against the other countries of the world and the changing of our own economy, I have some question that we have the political will to go through with what's necessary. And I see that, whether you want to call that, a sensuality, I wouldn't go quite that far. But I do think that to respond to the challenge, it takes a greater sense of work and a greater sense of discipline to make this country go forward. And every time I pick the newspaper up and read about these freaky characters and the whole bizarre behavior that seems to be the fascination of the press and presumably that of the readership, it gives me great concern about the continued viability of our institutions.
Governor, since the federal government today plays such an important role in state government, who is president must or should be of considerable interest to you? Do you have a choice among the Democratic candidates who've declared today?
No, not yet. And I found in the last election that premature involvement in presidential politics is not usually the wisest course.
Could you support any or all of them who have announced?
I haven't really given it that kind of attention, but I think...
You've given it no thought at all?
No, I've given it a few hours of thought since I've been governor. I think that I'd like to see a greater testing of these candidates, let them go through the combat and agon of a campaign, and possibly things will emerge that will separate out the strong from the weak and the clear from the muddled, and in due course I'll either support one or at least one.
You have been quoted as saying that you'd like to set a new course not only for the state but for the country. What qualities would you like to see in the next president, never mind the individual? What kind of approach would you like to see in the next president?
First and foremost, a clear mind, an ability to think and speak clearly. I think that whether it's the bureaucracy that is speaking more and more in code or politics that is speaking more and more in cant, the American people are looking for a clarity of statement of where we are and where we can go. And there's no point in kidding people that we're not up against tough times. We are. Beyond that, I think as a president, a person must be independent and must be grounded with a sense of history and basic principle that sees beyond the flotsam and jetsam of the momentary political story or incident, because the course of history is intractable and deep, and too much of our politics is of the moment, is of pragmatic, moving forward then moving backward. I think we're looking for an overall statement of where this country has been and where we're going, a redefinition of our manifest destiny so that people can see their own lives in terms of a greater vision and a future that fits into the reality of the changing balance of power in this country.
Since you mentioned clarity of language, I'd like to quote something the L.A. Times said you said. You said when they discussed the question.
That's always a questionable source.
Well, you can correct it if it's wrong. The question that was put to you was whether what you'd do if your name was placed on a presidential primary ballot somewhere, and you're quoted as saying, "I might leave it on, might take it off. I'm not locking myself in or out of anything." Now, I don't quite know what that means. Would you explain
that? I'd say that's a very accurate statement of my state of mind when I gave it to Mr. Burkholz one morning about a month ago.
What does that mean?
It means precisely what it says. I don't think I could either add or subtract from that.
Mr. Monroe.
Governor, talking against materialism as you do and as you have done on this program, does that mean you have what might be described as less than a full commitment to the profit motive?
No, I think the profit motive builds on a basic aspect of human nature that you can call a profit or greed or self-assertion or self-seeking. That is part of our makeup, and a system that takes advantage of that is certainly in tune with human nature. And I think the opposite side of the coin, central planning, has major defects and problems, and it's just a matter of harmonizing the two and tempering the excesses of both.
I'd like to ask you a quick political question. What about George Wallace as a Democratic candidate, either for president or vice president? Do you have any objections to him?
I don't see that as a realistic possibility in view of his background and and what he symbolizes in the political spectrum.
Do you have an objection to him?
Yes.
Mr. Browder.
Governor, a central issue in terms of federal, state, and local relations is what the government should do to help New York City in its fiscal crisis. Do you agree or disagree with President Ford's refusal to underwrite the bonds of New York City?
I would chart a new course. Basically, you cannot let 8 million people sink, but on the other hand, I think people ought to face up to the consequences of their own actions. Before any assistance should be given, there ought to be a redefinition of just what services are reasonable, and I think there needs a sense of reality in that city about what services and what wage levels and what pensions are reasonable, and just to bail them out without demanding a fundamental change in what's going on is ridiculous and it's just not helpful. I would say this, that if you begin to increase the efficiency of that system, you then face up to the other problem, which is tremendous unemployment. And if on the one hand you say, clean up your act, make your city more productive, you face the prospect of a lot of people out of work. And that's where you have to couple any program with a national commitment to full employment. And that I don't see Mr. Ford saying. But I think the great problem in government is it never goes bankrupt. Once you start a program, it never ends. And that is very dangerous. It becomes like a cancer. The more it grows, it just grows and grows and grows. It becomes a type of elephantitis that ultimately will destroy it.
I noticed in your budget statement that two-thirds of California's $300 million surplus comes from federal revenue sharing money. Does that reflect your sense of national priorities, that the federal government should be putting money into California when it is in surplus rather than New York when it's on the verge of bankruptcy?
Well, in a $12 billion budget, I wouldn't consider $300 million much of a surplus. That's barely a percentage point. And I think you need some prudent reserve. You don't spend down to the last penny. You have to keep some reserve for a rainy day.
The question was about federal government underwriting.
I think the federal government ought to provide revenue sharing and decentralize power wherever possible. The federal government, whether it be in HEW or in planning or in half the other things they're involved in, are institutionally incapable of dealing with local problems. And the challenge for the next 10 years is to redivide the responsibility between state, local, and federal government in a way that we haven't done up till now.
We have less than 3 minutes. Mr. Burkholz.
Governor, you have said that if work is interesting and challenging, people should be paid less. Those are the people who get great psychic rewards.
I have said that.
Their lives are better because they have the privilege of interesting work. Last week, sir, you signed a bill increasing the salary of state legislators. What category does that put them in?
Well, it puts them in a category at one half the wages of the United States congressman. And quite frankly, if you would like to know my reason for that, I'll tell you.
Yes.
I viewed that 5% salary increase over 2 years, compared it with the 8-9% salary increase of most public employees, and then gave proper deference to the other co-equal branch of the legislature, recognizing the need to work with them next year, and I signed the bill.
Mr. Will.
Governor, you expressed an interesting concept of representation when you said that you wanted to be the governor of the 54% of the people who didn't vote last year. How do you fashion a program for people who express no mandate?
To stand up to the special pleaders, they're encamped. Encircling the state capitol, and to see through their particular factional claims to the broad public interest, and to try to redefine that commonality of purpose and need that the vast number of people in this country who work hard, collect a paycheck, and don't have a lobbyist to pound on your door to get a special pension or a special loophole, they don't have that. And to try to see beyond that takes clarity and intestinal fortitude, and And to that extent, I try to represent that over 50%, that don't vote, I think, not out of really laziness, but out of a clear choice that whatever we're doing isn't worth commenting on one way or the other.
Mr. Monroe?
Governor, should policemen and firemen be permitted to strike?
No.
How do you stop them?
How do you stop them? That's a tough question, because if people want to withhold their labor, they will. The only way to do that is develop an appropriate collective bargaining machinery to anticipate the problem, to treat employees fairly, and to try to be as clever as they are in their negotiations, and to counterbalance management productivity with labor demands for rule
changes.
I'm
sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you, Governor Brown, for being with us today on Meet the Press. I'll tell you about next week's guest in just a minute after this message.
These rolling hills in Wyoming have been here for over 30,000 years. This hill has been here only 4 years. It's a man-made hill of earth and rock taken from an Exxon uranium mine. Instead of being an eyesore, Exxon contoured and seeded it to match the surrounding landscape. 100 miles away, an Exxon affiliate plans to open another mine, this time a coal mine. And we plan to reclaim the land the same way. Before we start digging for coal, these scientists from the University of Wyoming are studying the land that will be disturbed. They're carefully analyzing and cataloging almost every square foot of wildlife, plant life, and soil in the area. What these scientists learn will not only let us do a good job of reclaiming the land, it will help us turn it into better grazing land than it was before.
For a printed copy of today's interview, send 25 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C., 20013.
Next Sunday on Meet the Press, our guest will be Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State. Now, this is Lawrence Spivak saying goodbye for Governor Edmund Brown and Meet the Press.